With her long legs folded under her, Louisa Leuven sat on the hard deck in the noisome semi-darkness that was lit only by the feeble light of the fighting lanterns. Her shoulders were covered with a single thin cotton blanket of the poorest quality. The gun ports were closed and bolted. The guards were taking no chances. With the shore so close, some of the women might take the risk in the cold green currents, undeterred by the possibility of drowning or being devoured by the monstrous sharks that were attracted to these waters by the swarming seal colony on Robben Island. While the women had been on deck that afternoon, the cook had thrown overboard a bucket of guts from the Red Steenbras. The head jailer had pointed out to his prisoners the triangular fins of the sharks as they sped in to snatch these bloody morsels. "Don't any of you filthy slattens get any ideas of escape," he cautioned them. At the beginning of the voyage, Louisa had claimed for herself this berth under one of the huge bronze cannon. She was stronger than most of the other wizened, undernourished convicts, and, of necessity, she had learned how to protect herself. Life on board was like being in a pack of wild animals. The women around her were every bit as dangerous and merciless as wolves, but shrewder and more cunning. At the beginning, Louisa knew she had to procure a weapon, so she had managed to prise loose a strip of the bronze beading from under the carriage of the cannon. She'd spent long hours of the night stropping this against the cannon barrel until it had a sharp double stiletto edge. She tore a strip of canvas from the hem of her shift and wrapped it round the hilt to make a handle. She carried the dagger day and night in the pouch she wore strapped around her waist under the canvas shift. So far she had been forced to cut only one of the other women. Nedda was a Frieslander, with heavy thighs and bottom, fat arms and a pudding face covered with freckles. She had once been a notorious whore mistress for the nobility. She had specialised in procuring young children for her rich clients until she became too greedy and tried to blackmail one. On a hot tropical night, as the ship lay becalmed a few degrees south of the equator, Big Nedda had crept up on Louisa in the night and pinned her down under her suffocating weight. None of the jailers or any of the women had come to Louisa's rescue as she screamed and struggled. Instead, they had giggled and egged Nedda on. "Give it to the high and mighty bitch. Listen to her squealing for it. She loves it. Go on, Big Nedda. Shove your fist up that prim royal pussy." When Louisa felt the woman prise her legs apart with a fat knee, she reached down, slipped the blade out of its pouch, and slashed Nedda's chubby red cheek. Nedda howled and rolled off her, clutching the deep spurting wound. Then she crept away, sobbing and moaning, into the darkness. During the next few weeks the wound had festered, and Nedda had crouched like a bear in the darkest recess of the gun deck, her face swollen to double its size, pus leaking out through the dirty bandage, dripping yellow and thick as cream from her chin. Since then Nedda had kept well clear of Louisa, and the other women had learned from her example. They left her well alone. For Louisa, this dreadful voyage seemed to have lasted all her life. Even during this respite from the open sea, while the Mew lay at anchor in Table Bay, the magnitude of the ordeal she had undergone still haunted her. She cowered further into her refuge under the cannon, and shuddered as each of the separate memories pricked her like thorns. The throng of humanity was pressed close about her. They were packed so tightly into every inch of the deck that it was almost impossible to escape the touch of other filthy bodies crawling with lice. In rough weather, the latrine buckets slopped over and the sewage ran down the crowded deck. It soaked the women's clothing and their thin cotton blankets where they lay. During the occasional spells of calm weather, the crew pumped seawater down the hatches, and the women went down on their knees to scrub the planks with the coarse holy stones. It was in vain, for during the next storm the filth splashed over them again. In the dawn, when the hatches were taken off the companionways, they took turns to carry the reeking wooden buckets up the ladders to the deck and empty them over the side, while the crew and the guards jeered at them. Every Sunday, in any kind of weather, the prisoners were mustered on deck while the guards stood over them with loaded muskets. The women, in their leg irons and ragged canvas shifts, shivered and hugged themselves with their thin arms, their skin blue and pimpled with the cold, while the Dutch Reformed Dorminy harangued them for their sins. When this ordeal was over, the crew set up canvas screens on the foredeck, and in groups the prisoners were forced behind them, while streams of seawater were sprayed over them from the ship's pumps. Louisa and some of the more fastidious women stripped off their shifts and tried as best they could to wash off the filth. The screens fluttered in the wind and afforded them almost no privacy, and the seamen on the pumps or in the rigging overhead whistled and called ribald comments. "Look at the dugs on that cow! You could sail a ship of the line up that great hairy harbour!" Louisa learned to use her wet shift to cover herself as she crouched low, screening herself behind the other women. The few hours of cleanliness were worth the humiliation, but as soon as her shift dried and the warmth of her body hatched the next batch of nits, she began to scratch again. With her bronze blade she whittled a splinter of wood into a fine tooth comb and spent hours each day under the gun carriage combing the nits out of her long golden hair and from the tufts of her body hair. Her pathetic attempts at bodily hygiene seemed to highlight the slovenliness of the other women, which infuriated them. "Look at her royal bloody highness at it again, combing her bushy hairs! She's better than the rest of us, going to marry the governor of Batavia when we get there, didn't you know? You going to invite us to the wedding, princess? Nedda here will be your bridesmaid, won't you, Nedda Liefling?" The livid scar down Nedda's fat cheek twisted into a grotesque grin, but her eyes were filled with hatred in the dim lantern light. Louisa had learned to ignore them. She heated the point of her blade in the smoky flame of the lantern in the gimbal above her head, ran the blade down the seams of the shift in her lap, and the nits popped and frizzled. She held the blade back in the flame, and while she waited for it to heat again, she ducked her head to peer through the narrow slit in the joint of the port lid. She had used the point of her blade to enlarge this aperture until she had an unobstructed view. There was a padlock on the port lid, but she had worked for weeks to loosen the shackles. Then she had used soot from the lantern to darken the raw wood, rubbing it in with her finger to conceal it from the weekly inspection of the ship's officers, carried out on Sunday while the convicts were on the open deck for the prayer meeting and ablutions. Louisa always returned to her berth terrified that her work had been discovered. When she found that it had not, her relief was so intense that often she broke down and wept. Despair was always so near at hand, lurking like a wild beast, ready to pounce at any moment and devour her. More than once over the past months she had sharpened her little blade until the edge could shave the fine blonde hairs of her forearm. Then she had hidden away under the gun carriage and felt for the pulse in her wrist where the blue artery beat so close to the surface. Once she had laid the sharp edge against the skin and steeled herself to make the deep incision, then she had looked up at the thin chink of light coming through the joint of the port lid. It seemed to be a promise. "No," she whispered to herself. "I am going to escape. I am going to endure." To bolster her determination, she spent hours during those terrible endless days when the ship crashed through the high turbulent storms of the southern Atlantic, daydreaming of the bright happy days of her childhood, which now seemed to have been in another hazy existence. She trained herself to retreat into her imagination and to shut out the reality in which she was trapped. She dwelt on the memory of her father, Hendrik Lofen, a tall, thin man with his black suit buttoned high. She saw again his crisp white lace stock, the stockings that covered his scrawny shanks, lovingly darned by her mother, and the pinchbeck buckles on his square-toed shoes, polished until they shone like pure silver. Under the wide brim of his tall black hat, the lugubriousness of his features was given the lie by mischievous blue eyes. She had inherited hers from him. She remembered all of his funny, fascinating, and poignant stories. Every night when she was young, he had carried her up the stairs to her cot. He had tucked her in and sat beside her, reciting them to her, while she tried desperately to fight off sleep. When she was older, she had walked with him in the garden, her hand in his, through the tulip fields of the estate, going over the day's lessons with him. She smiled secretly now as she recalled his endless patience with her questions, and his sad, proud smile when she arrived at the right answer to a mathematical problem with only a little prompting. Hendrik Lofen had been tutor to the Van Ritters family, one of the preeminent merchant families of Amsterdam. Meneer Koen Van Ritters was one of Het 17, the board of directors of the VOC. His warehouses ran for a quarter of a mile along both banks of the Inner Canal, and he traded around the world with his fleet of 53 fine ships. His country mansion was one of the most magnificent in Holland. During the winter, his numerous household lived in Huis Brabant, the huge mansion overlooking the canal. Louisa's family had three rooms at the top of the house to themselves, and from the window of her tiny bedroom she could look down on the heavily laden barges and the fishing boats coming in from the sea. However, the spring was the time she loved the most. That was when the family moved out into the country, to Mooi Uitzicht, their country estate. In those magical days, Hendrik and his family lived in a cottage across the lake from the big house. Louisa remembered the long skeins of geese coming up from the south as the weather warmed. They landed with a great splash on the lake, and their honking woke her in the dawn. She cuddled under her eiderdown and listened to her father's snores from the next room. She had never again felt so warm and safe as she did then. Louisa's mother, Anne, was English. Her father had brought her to Holland when she was a child. He had been a corporal in the bodyguard of William of Orange after he had become King of England. When Anne was 16, she had been engaged as a junior cook in the Van Ritters household and had married Hendrik within a year of taking up her post. Louisa's mother had been plump and jolly, always surrounded by an aura of the delicious aromas of the kitchen, spices and vanilla, saffron and baking bread. She had insisted that Louisa learn English, and they always spoke it when they were alone. Louisa had an ear for language. In addition, Anne taught her cooking and baking, embroidery, sewing, and all the feminine skills. Louisa had been allowed as a special concession by Meneer Van Ritters to take her lessons with his own children, although she was expected to sit at the back of the classroom and keep quiet. Only when she was alone with her father could she ask the questions that had burned all day on the tip of her tongue. Very early she had learned deferential manners. Only twice in all the years had Louisa laid eyes on Mevrouw Van Ritters. On both occasions she had spied on her from the classroom window as she stepped into the huge black-curtained carriage, assisted by half a dozen servants. She was a mysterious figure, clad in layers of black-brocaded silks and a dark veil that hid her face. Louisa had overheard her mother discussing the Chatelaine with the other servants. She suffered from some skin disease which made her features as monstrous as a vision of hell. Even her own husband and children were never allowed to see her unveiled. On the other hand, Meneer Van Ritters sometimes visited the classroom to check on his offspring's progress. He often smiled at the pretty, demure little girl who sat at the back of the room. Once he even paused beside Louisa's desk to watch her writing on her slate in a neat and well-formed script. He smiled and touched her head. "What lovely hair you have, little one," he murmured. His own daughters tended towards plump and plain. Louisa blushed. She thought how kind he was, and yet as remote and powerful as God. He even looked rather like the image of God in the huge oil painting in the banquet hall. It had been painted by the famous artist Rembrandt Harmingszoon van Rijn, a protégé of the Van Ritters family. It was said that Meneer's grandfather had posed for the artist. The painting depicted the day of resurrection with the merciful Lord lifting the saved souls into paradise, while in the background the condemned were herded into the burning pit by demons. The painting had fascinated Louisa, and she spent hours in front of it. Now in the reeking gun deck of the Mew, combing the nits from her hair, Louisa felt like one of the unfortunates destined for Hades. She felt tears near the surface, and tried to put the sad thoughts from her mind, but they kept crowding back. She had been just 10 when the Black Plague had struck Amsterdam again, beginning, as before, in the rat-infested docks, then sweeping through the city. Meneer Van Ritters had fled with all his household from Huis Brabant, and they had taken refuge at Mooi Uitzicht. He ordered that all the gates to the estate were to be locked and armed sentries placed at each to deny access to strangers. However, when the servants unpacked one of the leather trunks they had brought from Amsterdam, a huge rat leapt out and scuttled down the staircase. Even so, for weeks they believed themselves safe, until one of the housemaids collapsed in a dead faint while she was waiting on the family at dinner. Two footmen carried the girl into the kitchen and laid her on the long table. When Louisa's mother opened the top of her blouse, she gasped as she recognised the necklace of red blotches around the girl's throat, the stigmata of the plague, the ring of roses. She was so distressed that she took little notice of the black flea that sprang from the girl's clothing onto her own skirts. Before sunset the following day, the girl was dead. The next morning, two of the Van Ritter's children were missing when Louisa's father called the classroom to order. One of the nursery maids came into the room and whispered in his ear. He nodded, then said, "Corbus and Tinus will not be joining us today. Now, little ones, please open your spelling books at page 5. No, Petronella, that is page 10. Petronella was the same age as Louisa, and she was the only one of the Van Ritter's children who had been friendly to her. They shared a double desk at the back of the room. She often brought small gifts for Louisa, and sometimes invited her to play with her dolls in the nursery. On Louisa's last birthday, she had given her one of her favourites. Of course, her nurse had made Louisa give it back. When they walked along the edge of the lake, Petronella held Louisa's hand. "Tinus was so sick last night," she whispered. "He vomited. It smelt awful." Halfway through the morning, Petronella stood up suddenly, and without asking permission, started towards the door. "Where are you going, Petronella?" Hendrik Leuven demanded sharply. She turned and stared at him with a bloodless face. Then, without a word, she collapsed onto the floor. That evening, Louisa's father told her, "Meneer van Ritters has ordered me to close the classroom. None of us is allowed up to the big house again until the sickness has passed. We are to stay here in the cottage." "What will we eat, Papa?" Louisa, like her mother, was always practical. "Your mother is bringing down food for us from the pantries, cheese, ham, sausages, apples and potatoes. I have my little vegetable garden and a rabbit hutch and chickens. You will help me work in the garden. We will continue your lessons. You will make swifter progress without the duller children to hold you back. It will be like a holiday. We will enjoy ourselves. But you are not allowed to leave the garden, do you understand?" he asked her seriously, as he scratched the red flea-bite on his bony wrist. For 3 days they had enjoyed themselves. Then the next morning, as Louisa was helping her mother prepare breakfast, Anne fainted over the kitchen stove and spilled boiling water down her leg. Louisa helped her father carry her up the stairs and lay her on the big bed. They wrapped her scalded leg in bandages soaked in honey. Then Hendrik unbuttoned the front of her dress and stared in terror at the ring of roses around her throat. The fever descended upon her with the speed of a summer storm. Within an hour her skin was blotched with red and seemed almost too hot to touch. Louisa and Hendrik sponged her down with cold water from the lake. "Be strong, Melifling," Hendrik whispered to her, as she tossed and groaned and soaked the mattress with her sweat. "God will protect you." They took turns to sit with her during the night. But in the dawn, Louisa screamed for her father. When he came scrambling up the stairs, Louisa pointed at her mother's naked lower body. On both sides of her groin, at the juncture of her thighs with her belly, monstrous carbuncles had swelled to the size of Louisa's clenched fist. They were hard as stones and a furious purple like ripe plums. "The buboes!" Hendrik touched one. Anne screamed wildly in agony at his light touch, and her bowels let loose an explosion of gas and yellow diarrhea that soaked the sheets. Hendrik and Louisa lifted her out of the stinking bed and laid her on a clean mattress on the floor. By evening her pain was so intense and unrelenting that Hendrik could bear his wife's shrieks no longer. His blue eyes were bloodshot and haunted. "Fetch my shaving razor," he ordered Louisa. She scurried across to the wash basin in the corner of the bedroom and brought it to him. It had a beautiful mother-of-pearl handle. Louisa had always enjoyed watching her father in the early mornings lathering his cheeks, then stripping off the white soap suds with the straight gleaming blade. "What are you going to do, Papa?" she asked as she watched him sharpening the edge on the leather strop. "We must let out the poison. It is killing your mother. Hold her still." Gently, Louisa took hold of her mother's wrists.
"It's going to be all right, Mama. Papa is going to make it better."
Hendrik took off his black coat and in his white shirt came back to the bed. He straddled his wife's legs to hold her down. Sweat was pouring down his cheeks, and his hand shook wildly as he laid the razor edge across the huge purple swelling in her groin. "Forgive me, O merciful God," he whispered, then pressed down and drew the blade across the carbuncle, cutting deeply and cleanly. For a moment nothing happened. Then a tide of black blood and custard yellow pus erupted out of the deep wound. It splattered across the front of Hendrik's white shirt and up to the low ceiling of the bedroom above his head. Anne's back arched like a longbow, and Louisa was hurled against the wall. Hendrik cringed into a corner, stunned by the violence of his wife's contortions. Anne writhed and rolled and screamed, her face in a rictus so horrible that Louisa was terrified. She clasped both hands over her own mouth to prevent herself screaming as she watched the blood spurt in powerful regular jets from the wound. Gradually the pulsing scarlet fountain shriveled, and Anne's agony eased. Her screams died away, until at last she lay still and deadly pale in a spreading pool of blood. Louisa crept back to her side and touched her arm.
"Mama, it's all right now. Papa has let all the poison out. You are going to be well again soon."
Then she looked across at her father. She had never seen him like this. He was weeping, and his lips were slack and blubbery. Saliva dripped from his chin.
"Don't cry, Papa," she whispered. "She will wake up soon."
But Anne never woke again.